Well, we began with a 20th century Russian composer. Given the mirror-like symmetry of the programme, it's a good encore with which to end. The first of Sergei Prokofiev's Opus 35 melodies from Chloe Hanslip and Danny Driver. Danny's going to be back at Wigmore Hall in May for a solo recital. That's on the 17th, Nocturnes. Have a look ahead on Wigmore Hall's website. Well, that was our first BBC Radio 3 lunchtime concert of the year. Next Monday, pianist Inon Barnata brings us two sets of musical moments written at opposite ends of the 19th century. Moments Musicaux by Franz Schubert and Sergei Rachmaninoff. I hope you'll join us.
Andrew McGregor there presenting from London's Wigmore Hall last Monday. And you can hear that recital he mentioned by Inon Barnata just after the 1 o'clock news tomorrow here on BBC Radio 3. Coming up in a moment, it's the Early Music Show, this afternoon exploring 18th century Europe's fascination with the Orient.
Private Passions on BBC Radio 3. Fascinating people and the music that has helped shape their lives.
I mean, my mum always was a bit worried that I was just listening to requiems all the time. So why didn't you get out of your room and go meet your friends? I was like, no, I love this.
Join Michael Barclay as he chats to a range of guests, including Grayson Perry, Darcy Bustle, the actor Brian Cox, and the comedian Chris Addison.
I remember my dad, who used to work after hours at the dining room table, listening very loud to Schubert or to this bagatelle, Middle European stuff, often.
To listen, just search Private Passions on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3. We'll hear music by Stanford, Purcell and Mendelssohn on the way in choral evensong in an hour's time. It comes from St Matthew's Church in Westminster at 3 o'clock. But now it's time for this week's edition of the Early Music Show, which is presented this afternoon by Mark Siow.
Thank you. character piece from Couperin's fourth book of harpsichord pieces from 1730, performed by Carol Chirazi. You might be surprised to learn that the movement is titled Les Chinois, that is, the Chinese. But what's so Chinese sounding about this little piece for harpsichord? It's full of French ornaments. It has patterns seemingly straight out of a harmony textbook by Jean-Philippe Rameau. And it even has a closing slow section, a typically French structure. Rhythmically, it's a little jaunty, so perhaps there's something evocative of a Chinese acrobat, but nothing too beyond the remit of what was expected at the Paris Ballet. So then, what's so Chinese about Les Chinois? Couperin's Les Chinois is indicative of a larger cultural phenomenon, chinoiserie, the fashion for all things Chinese across the important capitals of Europe. Porcelain, silk, carved ivory, furniture, tea. A huge market demand for these goods from China, or in the Chinese style, surged across 18th century Europe. As one writer put it in 1786, an English gentleman talks and dresses French. He sings Italian, his house is Grecian, his offices Gothic, his furniture Chinese. And that furniture included harpsichords. Two particularly splendid chinoiserie examples are housed in the Charlottenburg Palace in Berlin. They were made in around the year 1710, most likely by the harpsichord maker Michael Mika. These twin harpsichords, one in black, the other in white, were ornately decorated by Gérard Dagli, the royal decorator for the palace. Gilded across the harpsichord surfaces are Chinese men and women, dancing, making music and feeding peacocks, an Eastern Arcadia, if you like, a world of harmony and tea-drinking tranquility. These chinoiserie harpsichords were likely known by Johann Sebastian Bach, who in 1719 was commissioned by his employer to go to Berlin and buy a two-manual harpsichord made by Mika. Did Bach twirl his fingers on these very keys encased in chinoiserie? Here's the 13th variation from Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by Bob van Asperen on that very chinoiseried black Mika harpsichord. Thank you. The 13th variation from Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by Bob van Asperen. Like Couperin's Les Chinois that opened the show, there's nothing intrinsically Chinese about that movement by Bach. It's more that music became wrapped in chinoiserie, literally, in the case of Bach's harpsichord music. It was able to gesture to the Orient without sounding the least bit oriental. The term chinoiserie wasn't yet in circulation. French dictionaries suggest it was used only from 1839, some 50 years after the craze reached its peak in France, and much later than that in English. But perhaps that chinoiserie wasn't yet a word shouldn't be such a surprise. It's much more complex and intangible than just a market demand for things. It also conveyed the vogue for Chinese sensibility. The craze for porcelain and tea went hand in hand with the social context in which the ritual of tea drinking indicated sophistication. So while we might think that having a welcome cuppa is the most British thing possible, it's very much rooted in chinoiserie. And so this sets the scene for rethinking the relationship between Europe and China. Baroque music that we embrace as quintessentially English was coloured and shaped by all sorts of influences from beyond Europe. It's the idea of East and West not as a clear-cut binary, but instead as something in constant dialogue and exchange. And there's no better example of this than Henry Purcell's The Faerie Queen. The entry dance from Act 5 of Purcell's The Faerie Queen, performed there by the Orchestra of the 16. Well, to set the scene for The Faerie Queen's 1692 premiere in London, we only need to read the stage directions for the final act. While the scene is darkened, a single entry is danced. That's the music we just heard. Then a symphony is played. After that, the scene is suddenly illuminated and discovers a transparent prospect of a Chinese garden. The architecture, the trees, the plants, the fruit, the birds and the beasts. Quite different from what we have in this part of the world. It is terminated by an arch, through which is seen other arches with close arbours, and a row of trees to the end of the view. Over it is a hanging garden, which rises by several ascents to the top of the house. It is bounded on either side with pleasant bowers, various trees, and numbers of strange birds flying in the air. On top of a platform is a fountain, throwing up water which falls into a large basin. Purcell's The Fairy Queen is an adaptation of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And no, you haven't misremembered it. Shakespeare's Arcadia didn't feature a Chinese garden. So then, where did this idea spring from? One theory is that the chinoiserie scene marked the 15th wedding anniversary of King William and Queen Mary. Apparently, William had a passion for garden planning, and Mary was known for her magnificent array of Chinese porcelain, which she had started to collect living in the Netherlands. The Dutch East India Company brought masses of chinaware into Europe, and it was Mary's love for all things blue and white that stoked the craze in Holland and England. So, William's gardens and Mary's china, a Chinese garden. Purcell was nothing if not on point. Purcell's references to the pet passions of William and Mary in The Fairy Queen were undoubtedly an attempt to curry favour with the King and Queen. The death of Charles II brought a new landscape in which royal support for the arts was no longer to be taken for granted. So if the symbolism of the Chinese garden wasn't obvious enough, Purcell's next move was bolder. The Fairy Queen features two characters simply called a Chinese man and a Chinese woman. They go on to sing of the delights of their garden.
Pass, 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 the gold. As pure dreams, there was no room then, no room then, all empty fame. No cause for pride, no cause for pride, ambition wanted aim. Ambition wanted aim. The gloomy world at first began to shine. Thus, 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 the gloomy world at first began to shine. And from the gave it birth in light, which made it bright, which made it bright, and gave it birth in light.
Thus the gloomy world, and thus happy and free, sung by the Chinese Man, Women and Chorus from Purcell's Fairy Queen. William Christie conducted the singers of Les Arts Florissants. Next up, the Chinese Man continues, enraptured in beauty with the song Yes, Daphne, which is followed by the Monkey Dance. Purcell clearly didn't get the memo about working with children or animals, though it seems unlikely that real monkeys were used in the first production of The Fairy Queen. The idea shouldn't be entirely ruled out. The scene of the Chinese Garden was the most complicated setting the Dorset Garden Theatre Company had ever put on. And monkeys in London were a real thing. The plans that King William had for the gardens of Hampton Court and Kensington Palace most likely echoed his beloved gardens at Het Loo in the Netherlands. And from pictures, we know that those gardens teemed with all sorts of creatures, exotic birds perching everywhere, and yes, monkeys climbing trees. But as the musicologist Franz and Julie Muller write, unless bills for repairs of monkey damage turn up, we will probably never know for certain. Given the commotion and the smell, humans dressed as monkeys is perhaps a more believable theory. And to avoid these human monkeys looking ridiculously large, children would have been used, as they were 2 years earlier in the finale of Purcell's opera, Dioclesian. Here's the song Yes, Daphne, followed by Purcell's Monkey Dance.
Your eyes have made
Purcell's Monkey Dance was a jig, a comedic, even clumsy character dance capturing the monkeys at play. So then, a chaconne for a Chinese man and woman, a cheerful, pleasant way to bring the opera to a close. But Purcell scholars argue that it might not be that simple. The chaconne has its roots in the street dance tradition specific to Latin America and Spain, and the chaconne was associated with servants and slaves. Baroque opera often reinforced these references. For example, in Lully's first opera, Cadmus and Hermione from 1673, African dancers perform a chaconne, which leads to a marriage proposal. The musicologist Rose Prixma argues that French Baroque opera often preferred to associate sensuality with exotic people, rather than with their own representatives. The chaconne, as a Hispanic export, allowed for eroticism on stage while keeping that carnal desire distinct from the true Frenchman. Or in this case, the proper English gentleman and woman. In Purcell's The Fairy Queen, the dancers dressed in Chinese costume performed a chaconne, invoking the happy English marriage of King William and Queen Mary, but deflecting any lewdness or erotic desire onto its exotic characters. Here's the chaconne performed by Paul McCreesh and the Gabrielli Consort.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Early Music Show. I'm Mark Xiao, and today we're exploring chinoiserie, the 18th century craze for the Orient. So far, we've heard musical chinoiserie that didn't sound stereotypically Chinese, but some tunes circulated through Baroque Europe that did have a distinctly Oriental sound. In the 1760s, Jean-Jacques Rousseau published his Dictionnaire de Musique, an encyclopedia that, among its entries, included ancient non-European melodies, such as a song of the Canadian savages and a song from Persia. Another of these Rousseau labelled Air Chinois. Let's take a listen. Thanks to flautist Flavia Herta for recording that Chinese air from Rousseau's 18th century Dictionary of Music. Now, an almost identical tune appeared in the French translation of Li Guangdi's Guye Jingzuan. This translation was by a Jesuit missionary called Jean-Joseph Marie Amiot, who is best known as the author of a 1779 book about Chinese music traditions. This was a period when the flood of consumer goods from China, like tea and porcelain, was matched by a torrent of writings sent to Europe about China. Most of these were written by Christian missionaries of the Qing imperial court, focusing on how to convert China to Catholicism. These missionaries were extremely positive about China, praising its governance, its prosperity, the sensibility of its people and their Confucian rationalism. The imperial court at Beijing was described as the paragon of splendour, a model for European royal courts. Amiot left Paris in November 1749 and embarked on a six-month sea voyage. His ship presumably traced the coast of Africa across the Indian Ocean, scooped around India through the Strait of Malacca, finally to arrive at the South China Sea. After 9 months in Macau, Amiot arrived in Beijing, where he remained for the rest of his life. Once settled in the capital, Amiot drew upon one of the most powerful weapons in a missionary's arsenal, music. He entertained the Chinese elites by playing the harpsichord and flute. A movement by Jean-Joseph Marie Amiot to be played during communion, performed there by the flautist Jean-Christophe Friche. As well as composing, Amiot also introduced his 18th century Chinese listeners to music straight out of the Paris opera. Apparently, he played excerpts from Rameau's Les Sauvages and Les Cyclopes, all of which left his Chinese audience completely nonplussed. When Amiot asked for their thoughts, he was told, "Your music was not made for our ears, nor our ears for your music." Rameau's Les Cyclopes, performed there by harpsichordist Trevor Pinnock. As Jean-Marie Amiot sent collections of Chinese music and instruments to France, European instruments were received at the Beijing court too. Eager to convert the Chinese to Christianity, European missionaries recognised the importance the emperors attached to the rigorous study of cartography, astronomy and timekeeping. Music was considered akin to these practices. Matteo Ricci presented the first clavichord to China in 1601 to the Ming Emperor Wanli. And over a century later, the missionary Teodorico Pedrini gave the Changxi Emperor a clavichord for his birthday. Pedrini also called on Rome to send harpsichords to Beijing, as well as other musical materials, strings, manuscript paper, and compositions by Corelli and Bononcini. Indeed, held in the Chinese archives to this day are early editions of Corelli's trio sonatas that have been in China since the first half of the 18th century. So as chinoiserie flourished in Europe, Pedrini was feeding his Chinese listeners music from Italy. Inspiration flowed east and westbound.
Thank you.
the opening of Corelli's Opus 5 Sonata in A Major, played on the viola da gamba by Teodoro Bau with Andrea Bucarella on harpsichord. More about Corelli and Pedrini soon, but first, here's this week's edition of the Early Music News.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Barnaby Gordon, and in today's news, East meets West as three musicians from the Syrian ensemble Syriab and the Hanover-based trio Diroise take on Bach's Goldberg Variations. The album fuses Arabic percussion, rhythms and chants with the string players of trio Diroise, creating a collaboration that reinterprets the piece in a global improvisational setting. Here's Johann Caspar Wedel.
The idea behind Goldberg is that with our two different musical backgrounds, we wanted to take a new, equal and balanced look at Bach's Goldberg Variations. Various Arabic instruments appear. There's diud, a kind of Arabic lute, dikanun, a kind of sither, and various percussion instruments such as the rik and a buka. As the piece evolves, the Arabic influence becomes more audible, and we introduce traditional chants, which is sung by Abdel Hadi, Arabic makams, improvisations, quadratones, and dance meters, for example.
Johann Caspar Wedel. The album Goldberg by Syriab Trio and Trio Diroise is out now. Up next, the ensemble who have been described as early music's very own Spice Girls, a.k.a. the Palisander Quartet. Expect all things witchcraft and magic as they take their double-double toil and trouble programme to Albury next Friday, performing on recorders ranging in size from 6 inches to 6 feet, alongside choreography and movement.
Palisander really takes pride in presenting repertoire spanning 1,000 years in imaginative and innovative ways. We'll be performing a theme and variations on one of the 17th century broadside ballads by a Dutch composer called Sveelinck, with the original lyrics which tell of the trials of three suspected witches. The concert also features the magical dance of the tarantella, which in the 17th century it was believed could cure victims of poisonous spider bites. Providing they danced to the correct melody for their ailments, they would dance into a frenzy until they sweated out the poison and were miraculously cured. And as well as giving a historical context for the music, the concert will be interspersed with spoken word, poetry and singing.
That was Lydia Gosnell from Palisander, and they're performing at Albury's Jubilee Hall on Friday the 19th of January. And a highlight coming up on Radio 3... Next weekend's Sunday feature explores the music of the African-American civil rights activist and organiser of the 1963 March on Washington, Bayard Rustin, who used early music to spread his message of non-violence. And that's your early music news.
We're back into the world of chinoiserie behind the walls of 18th century Beijing, where Corelli's Opus 5 sonatas were almost certainly heard at court, thanks to missionary Teodorico Pedrini. Born in Fermo on the Adriatic coast, Pedrini lived in China for 36 years, 11 of those as a musician in the emperor's court. Far from home, Pedrini clearly could not get Italy out of his head. He composed a set of 12 sonatas for violin and bass under the pseudonym of Nepridi, a not-so-subtle anagram of his own name. These were highly influenced by his hero, Corelli. Now, Corelli's Opus 5 doesn't appear in the catalogue of the Chinese archives, but it was published in 1700, shortly before Pedrini left for China. Pedrini's manuscript suggests that he had access to an edition during his missionary years. There are even musical quotations of Corelli. Pedrini opens his collection with a tune whipped straight out of Corelli's first sonata. And there are other Corellian moments throughout Pedrini's music too, like this lively gavotte.
Thank you.
the Gavotte from Pedrini's Ninth Sonata, performed by Ensemble Sirocco. Now, the craze for chinoiserie didn't last. From the 1750s, it began to give way, and chinoiserie was soon cast as something frivolous. By the turn of the century, China in the European imagination was no longer a society of thoughtful philosophers, benevolent emperors, and luxury craftsmen, but rather a place of squalid decadence. Yet this couldn't supplant the rich impact that chinoiserie had had. It wasn't merely a flight of Rococo fancy, residing in objects such as a chair or teapot. It was a serious form of political and cultural exchange. The idea of Western Baroque music existing in cornered-off capitals of Europe simply doesn't hold up. Corelli and Rameau have been performed in China since the early 1700s, and Chinese tunes circulated throughout intellectual Paris, making their way into operas by Gluck and other European composers. In this kind of exchange, the binary of West and East dissolve, and chinoiserie is more than just a craze. It's a cultural current with a lasting legacy.
Thank you.
Weber's overture to his opera Turandot, played there by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Hans-Hubert Schonseler. And it brings to an end today's edition of the Early Music Show, which was presented by Mark Xiao and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. Next Sunday, Lucy Skeeping will be exploring the life and music of the 17th century Welsh composer Thomas Tomkins. That's here on BBC Radio 3 from 2 o'clock.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
Fancy a new routine for 2024? Why not wake up with BBC Radio 3? Ditch the abrasive alarm clock and start your morning like this.
Breakfast with Petroc Trelawney.
Weekday mornings from 6:30. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's 3 o'clock and time now on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds for Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast live on Wednesday from St Matthew's Church in Westminster in London. The canticles are sung to the set composed in the key of G minor by Purcell, and the anthem is There Shall a Star from Jacob Come Forth, a section of Mendelssohn's oratorio Christus, which tells of the star that led the wise men to Bethlehem to offer gifts to the newborn Jesus. The service opens now with an introit by Charles Villiers Stanford. Blessed are those that are undefiled in the way and walk in the law of the Lord.